zone is Section 325. Texas has its own vehicle limits, and we need to remind you to turn off cell phones to make it more noisy. We need to remind you to go buy books if you haven't done that yet. And what else? I think that's everything we have to remind you of. Today, the first speaker will be Ken Briggs, and he will take the first 25 minutes or 30 minutes. He is a career criminal defense lawyer specializing in the defense of death penalty cases. Since 1990, he has committed about 75 murders, about 50 of them capital cases in Florida, Texas, and Georgia. He has a second life as a legal and moral historian. In addition to his law degree, he earned a Master of Laws in Legal History from the University of Wisconsin. He has published numerous articles on Mormon legal history and criminal justice. And then the second speaker will be Roger Poole, who's admitted to practice law in Utah in 1987. His litigation practice focuses on the prosecution of child abuse, personal injury, wrongful death, civil rights, discrimination, and sexual harassment cases. Since 2004, he has represented numerous individuals in cases against the FLDS Church and Warren Jeffs. He is past president of the Utah Association for Justice, former trier. Utah Trial Lawyers Association, and past president of the Utah Employment Lawyers Association. He has served as a member of the Utah State Court's Career Service Review Board for the past 10 years.
Good morning. I am not speaking from a tank, so I've got to kind of outline. If you're interested in a more detailed account of what I'm talking about, the August issue of Sunstone, which they have a few copies still out on the table out there, has an 11-page, fairly dense article I wrote about the Texas cases. And I'm going to refer to that a little bit. Let me just give you a little personal history and how I came to this subject. As you heard, I'm a career criminal defense lawyer, which involves an awful lot of constitutional law, particularly capital cases. And I took a break from my law practice and got a Master of Laws. It's a, something after the JD that must be called E. In legal history at the University of Wisconsin. My major professor there pointed out this 1955 Utah Supreme Court decision called In Re Black that has to do with the parental rights of and so I wrote my thesis on that, published a portion of that thesis in the Utah Historical Quarterly. And the first time I ever heard of a fundamentalist woman was seeing a show on TV, a kind of cheesy thing called Brides of Chauvin. And in January 1988, I found Colorado City, went there, talked my way in, and met several people who have become long-term friends. And come back to that community often. I developed some friendships with families that were such that I started staying with those families many times. Just got to know people quite well on an intimate level and started writing a bit about it. And the attorneys who represented the FLDS in various subjects or kind of cases started retaining me as an expert witness on a fairly regular basis to help in those cases. So I have a pretty long-term record in that community. And saw it before the Warren Jeffs days and after it. It's the contrast of like turning on the lights in which the community is just completely changed. So anyway, let me get into this case a little bit. The title of my paper is actually a Los Angeles Times headline. The LA Times has been pretty hostile to fundamentalist Mormons and their coverage. The headline was an article about FLDS. In September 8th, 2002, Rulon Jeffs died. He was the prophet and leader of the community. He was 93 at the time. And fairly quickly, one of his many sons, Warren Jeffs, took over. At that point in time, the FLDS leadership was no longer a priesthood council like the beginnings of fundamentalist Mormon history, but one man. Pretty much unchallenged. I was a little surprised when Warren took over. I had known him a little bit. I was never particularly impressed with him down there. On December 1st, 2002, I was in the community for about a week. And that Sunday, I went to a Sunday church meeting. And a woman spoke. We which is very unusual. There was a very attractive young woman. Turned out to be Rebecca Wall, Jeff's Musser. She was a widow of Ruin. Late in Ruin's life, when Warren was like his chief assistant, Warren started marrying his father to a lot of attractive young women that I think Warren obviously had his eye on. And then after his father died, he started marrying off a number of his widows. The one who spoke was not Rebecca Musser, it was Naomi. And Naomi basically endorsed Warren as the successor to his father, saying that my husband Ruin wanted his son to succeed him.
Could you just get a little closer
to the mic? Okay, sorry, all right. And Naomi spoke endorsing Warren as her husband's or late husband's choice to succeed him. And it was shortly after that that Warren's leadership was pretty much cemented as the leader in the FLS group. Although there were certainly rivals, and there were certainly a lot of people that he saw as rivals, and he began excommunicating a number of men down there, including virtually everybody who was a close friend of mine. That's the reason Warner Rogers had no inside contacts in that community at all. Warren started having legal troubles on a lot of fronts, and by 2003-ish, he went on the underground, just sort of disappeared. The FLAS had begun buying up properties around the country that appeared to be intended as safe houses. And on one of those trips, he came across a very rural, sparsely populated county in West Texas, Schleicher County. The county seats a little town called El Dorado, which is under 2,000 people. It is very mean, scrub West Texas country. I can't imagine anybody would really want to live there. But they purchased 1,700 acres there, which eventually became the Yearning for Zion Ranch. And they bought it for about $700,000. At the time of the raid on the ranch, it was valued at over $20 million, and the FLDS property taxes constituted 20% of the county's total revenue. And also in 2003, there was the Rod Holm bigamy trial down in St. George, which resulted in the conviction of the beginning of criminal prosecutions in some of these cases. And that case, like many of the other prosecutions, involved child bride. It's only an underage person as a plural wife. Anyway, in May 2005, the United Effort Plan Trust, which is this communal United Order holding that owned virtually all the homes and businesses and property in the Short Creek area, which is Hilldale in Colorado City, was taken over by the state. The Board of Trustees were replaced by a conservator. That's ended up being just a sort of total disaster all the way around. It had become an entity that Warren completely controlled and became a vehicle for him to control his community. So in June 2005, Warren Jeffs gets indicted by Arizona, and in April 2006, he's indicted by Washington County for being an accomplice to rape. And the case involved a 14-year-old girl who was married to her cousin, whom she disliked, who's considerably older. They had what they call placement marriage in Colorado City, which is basically where the prophet decides who's supposed to marry who. You get told in the abstract, you know, that you have a right to refuse this, but as a reality, most people don't and can't. Anyway, this young woman did not want to be married to this person, had gone to Warren several times. He actually performed the marriage before his father had died, and was asking to be released from this call, to not be married to this individual. And they refused. Warren refused. And eventually, the marriage was consummated under circumstances that she regarded as rape. So Warren gets indicted for accomplice to rape. Now, the rapist has not been indicted at this point, which is, as a criminal lawyer, I find that odd. So Warren is trying to avoid being taken into custody on those charges as well. He ends up on the 10 most wanted list for the $60,000 reward. He's kind of running around the country popping up in these church safe houses from time to time, collecting monies that have been donated by his followers. And on August 28, 2006, he is taken into custody on a traffic stop on I-15 outside of Las Vegas. A state trooper pulled him over and something to do with a tag violation. And they eventually figure out this is a person of interest. Backup officers show up and he's taken into custody. The car and their Naomi, favorite wife, is in the car with him as his brother of his is driving, but warns them about taking into custody. In the car, they find a good bit of cash, a lot of prepaid cell phones, disguises, and some audio recordings that later the state represented in Texas has audio recordings of Warren having sex with 12-year-old brides with an audience. They're pretty muffled. They're not real clear, but they're creepy. I heard of a guy. So he is extradited to Utah, and on September 25th, 2007, he's found guilty of accomplice to rape in a trial in St. George. Now, this is a solid criminal defense lawyer you're hearing this from. In the course of the trial, the prosecution basically snookered the judge into giving a jury charge that pretty much dictated that the jury find Warren guilty. The state's theory was that because he was a religious leader, he had all this influence over this woman and essentially forced her to participate in something that became rape. Eventually, the Utah Supreme Court unanimously said, no, you can't do that, and reversed the conviction. But by this time, Warren's in custody. He's never coming out of custody. He never gets bond. And the reversal of the Utah Supreme Court is 2010. So shortly after that, in December 2010, Warren is extradited to Texas. Now, at this point, Texas has already done the raid. Well, let me talk about the raid a little bit and then I'll come back to Warren's case. In March and April of 2008, the Child Protective Services people in West Texas out around El Dorado start getting phone calls on their hotline from a young woman who represents herself as a 16-year-old bride at the Yearning for Zion Ranch who is being abused and a lot of things done to her that are in violation of Texas law by her husband, and she names the husband. But it later turns out this woman's crazy. She's in Colorado, she's mentally ill, she's had a history of these kind of fake calls. The calls were totally bogus. But at the time of the raid, the state regarded them as legit, and they got a judge to issue two separate search warrants on the Yearning for Zion Ranch. They're extremely broad search warrants. They go in and basically search every building, every square inch of the ranch. And also by this point, about 440 kids have been taken into custody by the state of Texas, which was just completely unprepared for dealing with that number of kids. They started farming them out in foster care all over the state. They're breaking up families. It was mishandled, just about every week mishandled. But in the search, the authorities find there's a temple there that looks a bit like the St. George Temple. And then there's a temple annex. Each of them have bank vaults with very serious doors and security in them. And the officers regard the search warrants as covering that. The FLBS are really offended by this, and there's a lot of sort of passive-aggressive resistance to it. There's no violent resistance. They're easily put in, but there wasn't. So when they come to the first vault, they basically get a jackhammer and drill a hole in the wall. They get some smallish Texas Ranger who strips down to his underwear and crawls through the hole with a flashlight and a pistol. Gets inside the vault, opens it up from the inside, and they start searching. And they're just banker boxes of records, flash drives, just, I think I've heard it referred to as 80 megabytes or trigger bytes, just some enormous amount. I'm not a computer guy, amount of data. And one of the things about Warren is he's like revelating every 20 minutes. And he's got somebody following him around and taking this down. And he's got pictures and audio recordings and all kinds of stuff, in addition to all these family histories back in the vault. So that's the search of the annex vault. The next day, they finally fly in a locksmith from San Antonio, and he's able to get in the vault in the temple, and it's got more data. So, I mean, they don't really know what they've got. It takes two or three full-time people with the Texas Rangers 3 years to go through and organize all of that data. And so they're finding dates of birth, wedding ceremonies. They've got records of about 70 marriages of Warren to brides. So there's one day when he marries four 12-year-olds in a day. And I mean, the age of the brides just gets lower and lower and lower. And until it's, I mean, there's just no way around it. It's children. In my view, Warren's a pedophile. I don't know that you can characterize it any other way. Speak up. Anyway, Warren's got a thing for 12-year-old girls, and he's marrying a lot of these kids. Now, Texas law, sex acts with these children would frequently be regarded as what most states call statutory rape. Consent's not an issue. The presumption is below a certain age or too young to consent. Texas has that kind of law, and they call it sexual assault. And they have two levels. There's an aggravated sexual assault or sexual contact with a child under the age of 15, and then there's sexual assault for, you know, 15 to majority. And the maximum sentence for sexual assault is 20 years. The maximum sentence for aggravated sexual assault is life. And so they are able to put together records that lead to indictments against Warren for those two offenses and some others, but also indictments against a number of other FLDS men who were at the ranch. And it looks to me like Warren was beginning to run into some resistance back in Colorado City with his sort of base group there. And the ranch was established as a place to bring the most loyal, the most intense followers. Looks like they had about 1,400 people there. They have some in other outposts around the country. Since all of these events have happened, I'm told there's about 1,000 people, primarily from the ranch, who are now at an outpost outside of Pringle, South Dakota, but there are other locations around the country where some of his former followers are, and they're still very loyal to him. Anyway, so these are the charges that are facing Warren when he is brought to Texas from Utah. When he flies in, he begins what I call this conga line of lawyers. He would hire people, apparently pay them their fees in full in advance, and with non-refundable clauses in whatever agreements there were. Then every few months he'd fire somebody and another set of lawyers would come in. Just kind of from listening to the gossip amongst the lawyers, it sounds to me like the fees may have been more than $500,000 by the time it was over. And they're all paid in full. And he finally settles on a pretty experienced, well-known, high-dollar defense team out of the Dallas area. And as the trial is approaching in 2011, July and August of 2011 is when it happens, I get a call in Atlanta from these lawyers. And they were looking to retain me as an expert witness and consultant to the trial. And I didn't commit to them on the phone. They called me on Friday. And that turned out to be the last day to file a witness list. And I didn't know that. They didn't tell me. And I said, well, I have to think about it. So let's talk again Monday. And I never heard back. And apparently they did file a witness list listing me as a witness. And so a week or so later, I hear from another lawyer down in Houston, a woman lawyer, who tells me that those guys have been fired. And she's now next up on the list. And she's still interested in using me. And as I told the first group of lawyers, and I told her, you need to look at my publications. And I made them available to them. Most of them are published online, so they put them out. Because I had written some stuff that I knew Warren didn't like, or I assumed Warren didn't like. He never told me anything, but the subjects were such that I'm sure he didn't appreciate it. And your client may not be happy about me being involved in this case, so just be sure he's okay with my coming in. Because I'm not backing off of my writing and my testimony. And this woman lawyer in Houston, they wanted an affidavit from me that they said they were going to use for some sort of new motion. And then they started sending me all this affidavit. They were going to draft it. And it was all this religious gobbledygook. It had no legal consequence to me, and I called it back, so I'm not signing that. And the way we left it is that I was going to come out to Texas and meet with them to prepare for the trial. We never talked about a fee. Frankly, I've been a little concerned about a fee because I knew people were like, you know, just to drain the money, so I never asked for or received a fee. So anyway, I show up in San Angelo, Texas, where the trial was going to be, and call them and say, okay, I'm here, where do we meet? Let's set up a schedule to prepare. And the response I get is, it was obvious they were surprised I was there. We'll call you back in a few minutes. And about 15, 20 minutes later, Lyle Jess calls back, and that's who Sue Warren's spokesman in the free world, and said, you're fired. So I was not involved with the defense team at that point, but motions were coming up, so I stayed in town and I attended the motions and kind of got a sense of what was going on. And while the motions were going on, there's yet another lawyer shows up, a woman from Houston who had been discharged. And this is like the seventh or eighth lawyer at this point. All of them have been paid. And finally, at the end of the motions, Warren announces he's going to represent himself. Lawyers call that going pro se. Our courts call that pro se. Lawyers call that a train wreck. The trial was not to start for like a week and a half. And I just decided to go back to Atlanta and kind of follow the press. I got a subscription to the local newspaper, which covered it pretty well. And it absolutely was a train wreck from a defense standpoint. He had some legal issues, but it was just beyond embarrassing to watch or painful to read about anyway. But apparently the issue with firing lawyers was he didn't want them to review the discovery. Discovery is a process you go through in a trial where the state has to give you what they got, and you're supposed to get what you got. Everybody sort of cheats on that a little bit. But the discovery that the state had included, these audio recordings of Warren having sex with 12-year-olds and a lot of other really vile stuff, and plus the records of the ages of all of his wives. And he apparently did not want that to come out, which is pretty unrealistic thinking it's not going to, because it's in discovery, it's going to come in as evidence of a trial. And so his deal with his lawyers was, you cannot look at discovery. And many of the lawyers were saying, I cannot represent you without looking at discovery. And that impasse got people fired. And when you're at the trials and you saw some FLDS people there with the motion hearings too, you see guys get up and leave the courtroom and then come back in. Whenever there was some discussion of discovery or any of the stuff Warren didn't want out, they leave the courtroom and then they come back. Afterwards, they regarded it as sacred and holy, and they weren't supposed to be exposed to it, when it really was just pedophilic fantasy. So the trial ended up predictably. Warren was convicted on both counts. The jury heard the audio tapes, and they heard from a woman named Rebecca Wall Jeff's Muscle. She's the author of a book called The Witness Wore Red, and is kind of making a living as a professional FLDS refugee now. There is, in the interim, after all of these kids have been seized, the Texas court said, the courts in the area had just violated every aspect of the statute. They had to return all the children, and they did. A lot of these involved the victims in Warren's case, and everybody's gone. They don't know where these people are. They split as soon as they could get out of the jurisdiction for it. So they've got no witnesses to come in and testify in trial that I'm the victim. Now, there is an exception to the live evidence in criminal law called hearsay. Hearsay is you can't testify to stuff you did not personally see or observe or experience yourself. there are hearsay exceptions, one of which is religious records. Religious records are presumed to be reliable because of the faith of the parties, and therefore religious records can come in as hearsay exceptions. Now, Warren's religious records were not what, you know, the Presbyterians and the Catholics are probably keeping. But this Rebecca, on, had been married to Rulajev's when she's like 19 and he's like 89. And she's living in his home. She is not actually preparing these records, but as these records have come through Rulin's home, they were prepared, organized, and stored by Rulajev's wives. And Rebecca is viewing these things. So she is used by the state as an expert, sort of expert witness, to authenticate these records. Yes, that's a religious record. That's a religious record. That's a religious record. Then she's identifying the parties. So she is, in essence, the state's case. She's paid a pretty large amount of money. They deny that it's a witness fee or anything like that, you know, but she gets $50,000 to $60,000 for her testimony. She testifies in all of the trials. There are a total of 13 convictions that come out of the raid in Texas. Warren's just one of them. She's a witness in virtually all of them. I can't think of one where she's not a witness. And so that's how they build their case against Warren. He's convicted. And Texas has a jury sentencing. A defendant has to opt between sentencing between the judge or the jury, the same jury that heard the evidence of the guilt phase part of the trial. This particular judge was incredibly hostile. I think she should have been recused. The recusal motion was filed, which they will deny. So the defendants all decided they want a jury sentence. Those who didn't plead, about half pled guilty, they worked out deals with the prosecutor, about half had jury sentence. So Warren's jury sentencing is in the tapes, the audio recordings, and all this dirt. And Warren decides, even though he's representing himself, he does not wish to be in the courtroom for that proceeding. So he is taken off to a side courtroom, and they've got, a TV monitor in there, and he's viewing what's going on there. But there's really no cross-examination, not that there was any when Warren was at the counsel table. He would appear to periodically stand up in the middle of the trial and revelate for a while. But it did not impress the jury. Sometimes he'd make an objection and he'd stand up and talk for 45 minutes to object to something, and it wasn't even a legal objection, just, I don't like this. But anyway, so after the jury hears all this, they come back with a maximum sentence. Life plus 20 years. Warren's not coming out. He is now in prison in Palestine, Texas. He had the right to appeal. There were some decent issues raised in pretrial motions that were followed by people with JDs. So there was a bit of a record on some of this. But, you know, he's got no lawyer. So the last day of the timeline, he files a pro se notice of appeal, which is, you know, kind of gibberish, but the courts were, okay, we'll take this as a notice of appeal. And the rules are in Texas that if you're not indigent, and none of these defendants have asked for court-appointed counsel or indigency, they all come in with retained counsel, you have to bear all the costs of your appeal. You and your lawyer have to sit down with the clerk of the court and put together a record. And an appeal is not, I don't like the outcome, you know, the jury shouldn't decide that. You have to have specific legal claims that say this law was violated here, the Constitution was violated here. And you have to make sure that the court reporter transcribes the testimony of the proceeding where that part of it took place. You have to be sure that those motions and other documents are in the appellate record that goes up on appeal. Warren apparently didn't understand that or didn't wish to proceed on it. So no record on appeal was ever prepared. And but what he did do was revelate fairly regularly. And he'd send the appellate courts these revelations. Some of them were pretty threatening. And finally, the appellate courts just said, okay, appeal denied for lack of warrant of prosecution, which is basically the legal term for you didn't do what you're supposed to. So his appeals are all over. Warren's dying inside. He He's single-celled and solitary. He gets out for a shower periodically. He gets a little bit of exercise, but they're not putting him in the yard with any other inmates, which is probably a good thing. I think he lasts about 20 minutes. Given the kind of clients I represent who have been in prison, I just don't think they'd be able to place for him. And I think it would probably end up making him a martyr, you know, right after he got shamed. Now, the other guys did pursue some appeals. They stopped them. But one appeal that concerned me a bit, there were challenges to the searches of the ranch. That this was an illegal search, that the judge did not have probable cause to issue these search warrants, and that the breadth of the search was too broad. And, of course, the main issue was things seized in the churches, the temple, to a lesser extent, things seized from people's homes. And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, or District Court of Appeals in Austin, approved the searches in an opinion that, as a civil libertarian, it sort of scares me to death. What they said is, churches are not places where people live. You don't have to have a search warrant to search a church. Anytime the police have some suspicion or don't like something going on in the church, they can bust in there and search it. There's no protection in a church. Any search of the church is okay. That bothers me a lot. That's the state of the law in Texas. They also said that if people are living in homes in a communal facility, you don't have a deed or a land or a title to this home, therefore you have no right to privacy, and the state can bust in there and search it. It's really, as lawyers said, really, really bad law. I can't imagine that it would have held up in federal courts for the next set of appeals in Texas. But after that opinion came down, Warren pulled the plug on all appeals. That opinion is now controllable, not necessarily controllable, but I mean, it's the predominant law in Texas on these kinds of searches. Let's see. I want to be sure to leave time for questions for everybody, so I'm abbreviating some of this. Seizures, seizure of the ranch. The ranch is, you know, I don't know what value it may have to anybody else, but it's sitting out there in West Texas. And the state filed a kind of a RICO action to seize the ranch, all the buildings, you know, virtually everything on it. It's under a state version of the RICO Act. RICO is racketeering and organized crime. Basically, the theory of it is that if you're using property to facilitate criminal activity, the state can come in and take it. You're driving down the interstate with a van load of pot, you know, and you get pulled over. They can not only take your pot, they can take your van. Okay. In this case, the state's theory was that the ranch was essentially a facility and used entirely to facilitate child rape. So they filed this action. They served everybody they could get served who was appropriate to be served, including Warren. And they got no response. The FLDS never put in a notice of appearance, or no lawyer ever appeared on their behalf. There were a lot of delays in the proceeding because the state was trying to get, you know, somebody to respond to or go to court with. The judge assigned the case with the same judge who had presided over the other trials. Again, I think she should have been recused, but there was nobody there to even ask for it. Eventually the state got the ranch. They got everything in it. I don't know what they're going to do with it. I've heard some rumors that some energy people are interested in buying it to house workers in that part of Texas, and maybe to do some fracking out there underneath the land. El Dorado's not a very attractive place. There's maybe, you know, 2,000 people living there. It's not a resort community. I just don't know what they're going to do with it. If they try to sell it to somebody under the circumstances, they're liable to have sort of title issues. But the state of Texas now owns the year interest on the ranch. I think that's all I'm going to go through right now. And I want to be sure Roger has time to cover some a different kind of part of this case. And I hope you'll have questions. I mean, our heads, both of us, are just full of information about this stuff. Thank you for joining us.
spoken as a good criminal defense lawyer. Okay. Because I'm hard of hearing. I know how it is to struggle. Okay. Is this better? In November of 2003, Warren Jess received a revelation that the Lord is showing me the young girls of this community. Those who are pure and righteous will be taken care of at a younger age. As the government finds out about this, it will bring such a great pressure upon us, upon the families of these girls, upon the girls who are placed in marriage. And I will teach the young people that there is no such thing as an underage priesthood marriage, but that it is a protection for them if they will look to it right and seek unto the Lord for testimony. And the Lord will have me do this, get more young girls married, not only as a test to the parents, but also to test this people to see if they will give up the prophet. A little bit later, he received this message. The Lord wanted me to receive this 13-year-old bride for her deliverance, as well as the Lord allowing this to be a reason in the government's eyes to come stronger against this people. By me performing these works that would bring the wicked against us to justify the Lord in destroying them at a wicked pace. So there are not only there's not only a change here to really emphasize underage marriages, there is an apocalyptic overtone that has occurred. These are revelations not in Texas, these are in Short Creek, down here on the Utah-Arizona border. Now, Short Creek, as Ken mentioned, is land held in trust, United Effort Plan Trust, which has been built up by the FLDS people since 1942. This is what was said during a trust meeting that was recorded in September of 2004. This is Warren talking. This is an official trust meeting of the United Effort Plan Trust. Dear brethren, we are under attack. We now have three lawsuits filed against us. My lawsuits, by the way. My clients, including Elisa Wall a little bit later. They are direct attacks against the celestial law and priesthood. And I tell you this much, that the Lord is requiring of me to answer them nothing. He is saying, the Lord requires of me to answer the courts nothing. And if you follow the news, he didn't respond to the courts for years. The revelation, answer the courts nothing, changed to hire the best criminal defense lawyers as you can after he was arrested. And then, of course, they didn't stick around because he wouldn't let them look at the discovery, like Ken mentioned. But, brethren, this will bring the government down upon us quickly, even put the IDF plan trust lands under government control. Very prophetic. Dear brethren, this is a test the Lord is allowing to come upon the priesthood people to see what we love most. Do we love the prophet and the priesthood and the celestial law more? Or will we surrender priesthood and give up the prophet to hold on to our lands and our earthly comforts? He's getting the people ready for a test, much like in the 1880s. See what they love most. And actually, he's telling the people that they can't participate in these trials, in these cases, no matter what the cost. And the reason for that is because the evidence will expose that he has put the long-time fundamentalist belief in celestial marriage, which does include underage marriage from time to time, and it always has, ever since Helen Mar Kimball married Joseph Smith at 14. He's putting underage marriages on steroids. He is taking that through the roof, and that's why so much attention is being drawn to the FLDS 10 years ago. And then he's reflecting, this is something he wrote in 2005. The Lord revealed to me that in 2003, a secret combination was in place between the apostates everywhere, many of them, and the government officials. Then he talks about a conspiracy involved taking me captive, putting me in jail, bringing forth witnesses, to call us criminals by performing marriages, so-called underage marriages. In 2005, he dictates a training that he wants his people to go through, those who are worthy enough to be called to these lands of refuge. Texas was known as L-17, if I recall right, in their code. These lands of refuge, or maybe it was R-17. But in any event, he wants them trained. And I say unto you, brethren, no person, no court, no government, no people on the face of the whole earth has the right or authority to bring God into question. What he and his prophets do in the celestial law among his priesthood people on his consecrated lands. That is what these present lawsuits and attacks are about. And so the Lord told me, answer them nothing and don't give them any testimony or witnesses. Now, as he is moving his most loyal followers out of Short Creek, that's Hillbilly, Utah, Colorado City, Arizona, he has to tell the people why that is happening. And in February of 2005, he prepared this training. And he said, I tell you, brethren, also the Lord has rejected Short Creek, but he will preserve the faithful who will turn unto him. The greatest persecutors that will come against us are still among us, the half-hearted who will fall away. He's afraid of his people in Short Creek. He knows that some of them, not many of them, but some of them are willing to question a little bit. And he's afraid that that's going to be his downfall. Later, he says, the United Effort Plan is rejected of God. People must qualify to come to the lands of refuge or else be rejected. That takes us to Texas, one of the compounds that exists. Ken did a great job explaining what's happened there, although I would characterize some of the things different being on the other side of it from the legal standpoint. It's important to understand that, that underage marriages have always existed in the church in fundamentalism. They were no stranger in the FLDS context. But to be invited to go to Texas or to some of these other places, you had to be considered very worthy and you had to be trained. And the training is very, very important to one. It focuses, in my mind, on really three things. Absolute obedience. And when I say absolute, I mean absolute. It focuses on absolute secrecy. Nobody keeps secrets better than the FLDS. And it focuses on the FLDS teaching of stewardship. Children, women and children, are stewardships. They do not belong to a husband. They do not belong to parents. They belong to God and the priesthood. They are the property of the priesthood. And they can be exchanged. That's why within that community, if a woman feels that her husband is not worthy enough to take her to the celestial kingdom, she can go to the prophet, express that concern, the prophet may reassign her and the children. The marriages are done spiritually, the divorces and the adoptions are done with the wave of the hand. There are no protections for children. All my cases for 10 years have really been about children. And a personal note, I should just add that if I had been born and raised there, I would have been in the same boat. And maybe I would have been tossed out of the boat, because I do question, I've been sunscreened for a long time. And maybe I would have been once tossed out of the boat, but it's also important to remember that if you're tossed out of the boat, your family stays in the boat and drifts away. Thousands and thousands of people have been severely injured in is nothing compared to what Warren Jeffs has done to his own people. And it's an ongoing humanitarian problem.
The what is
the 1953 raids, just child's play. So we get to Texas. Ken did a great job of that. I'm going to refer to a 2008 study by the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services very briefly. And maybe I will just summarize. They found a lot of evidence as soon as they got on the ranch of very young-looking girls that seemed to be pregnant or mothers. And they had no idea what they were doing. All they knew is they had an obligation under Texas law to investigate this hoax complaint. It was a hoax. But they got there, they had a huge problem, and they took 463 children into protective custody, realized that some 28 of them were not underage, and they had a huge problem because witnesses were not cooperating, answering nothing. And then the media took over and very well orchestrated a media campaign, put Texas in shame, and eventually they gave them all back. They're gone. Where are they now? So one scholar has looked at this and said, Texas authorities determined that of the 53 girls aged 14 to 17, 31 have children or are pregnant. It was just very, very common and very problematic. Now, the other problem is it cost Texas, in December of 2012, $12,436,310 to discharge their obligation as a child protective service. And that's a huge amount. And then they started the prosecutions. And as Ken mentioned, there were, I think, 11 or 12 men convicted on sex assault rape charges involving little girls. That is with no cooperative witnesses. That's just based on the evidence that we're able to seize. I've got a binder up there with hundreds of photographs. Anybody wants to just take a look at some of the photographs. And it wasn't just the underage girls that sickened the juries. Under Warren Jeffs, underage marriage became the new plural marriage. And not only that, but he was having sexual relationships with corners of wives. And he audio taped them. And this was in the temple where there are beds. Hot tubs or baptismal fonts. Disgusting, disgusting things that the FLDS people do not know about. It is so sacred that it has to be secret, and they are not allowed to know these things. If you ask them about it, they will not listen to you. They don't believe it. They believe the prophet can do it wrong. Which is a wonderful example of the dangers of exclusivity. You know, we need to have a common denominator in our country, and that has to be the rule of law. Because if not, if we don't all agree on a basic rule of law, then what prevents somebody from flying an airplane into your building? What prevents somebody from being a law unto itself and systematically institutionalizing pedophilia and drawing on the believing yet ignorant very serious problems, and it's not over. It's still happening. We can talk about that.
Anytime.
The title of the paper that Ken, I didn't know that he borrowed it from New York Times.
Los Angeles Times.
I've always thought that title didn't quite fit, and that is Texas has a different view of polygamy. Am I out of time?
Yeah, just okay.
I don't know that they were really viewing polygamy at all. I think they were viewing pedophilia, and they have a correct view of pedophilia. Their report, and then I could go on forever, but their report ended with this statement, which I thought was important. And we need to keep this in mind, and I wish some other jurisdictions would be this tough on this as well. For the Department of Family and Protective Services, the Yearning for Zion case is about sexual abuse of girls and children who were taught that underage marriage is a way of life. It is about parents who condone illegal underage marriages and adults who fail to protect girls. It has never been about religion. And I think that's really the case, but I look forward to helping out with some questions.
I have a lot of, all of my good friends within the FLDS got excommunicated by Warren. Frankly, I've been a little concerned that it was because of their association with me. I've recently had a lot of contacts with FLDS refugees telling me, their stories. I'm hearing that about half of the 10,000 or so people who were believers, I guess at the time of his father, they're down to about half. I suspect there are some people in the community who are just kind of keeping their heads down, trying not to get hit by the flak. There are a number of people leaving the community. There are people of goodwill, particularly in Utah, who are trying to help these people transition. It's a very hard transition for many of them. There are a couple of sort of rival community church leaders down there who've got some people gathering around them. And then there are people spread around the country in these various, forgot to turn my phone off. These various places of refuge. I don't know what's going on there. I haven't heard a whole lot of information about that. I think it's too soon. I think it's going to take a while for things to sort of settle out down there. Warren still has a following. He's getting people visiting him in prison, I understand. I've been trying to get from the Texas prison system the names and numbers of visitors he has and how frequently, and mail and phone calls, things like that. They regard that as information they can't disclose. I'm told that he gets a lot of letters from members, basically sucking up to him. But I just think it's going to take 10 years for this to really settle out.
It's a very painful time for the FLDS people. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, it's a very painful time for the FLDS people. More and more of them are allowing themselves to wonder whether maybe they need to reassess the prophet can do no wrong thing that they relied on so desperately. Cognitive dissonance is a huge problem. We have a humanitarian problem going on. It's going to get worse. At this point, if one of the major teachings in the FLDS Church is that if you're an apostate, you cannot have anything to do with FLDS people. And the teaching from Warren Jeffs is that an apostate from this work is the most dark person on earth. They are a liar from the beginning. They have made covenants to abide the laws of God and have turned traitor to the priesthood in their own existence, and they are led about by their master, Lucifer. This applies, and Nadine Hansen, who's here, and I, Nadine represented the children of one of my clients who tried a case a couple of months ago where the mother, one of the mothers of these children, had to acknowledge that she believed this. And the problem was that these minor children are now in the custody of the father, and they, even though it's a very fundamentalist home, they are seeing that there was a problem. And the 17-year-old had desired to stay with his father, loves his mother, but wanted to stay with his father and did not want to say, you know, I'm for Warren Jeffs. And his mother treated him as an apostate at that point and admitted it during the trial. Warren Jeffs goes on and says, the great challenge among this people is that the apostates are our relatives. If a mother has apostate children, her emotions won't let her give them up. And she invites them into the home. This mother had stopped doing that. And they desecrate the home. She didn't want her home desecrated. Well, you can imagine what the judge is thinking. And it just goes on and says, you must leave them alone severely. And that's been the problem. They will not talk to anybody. They have no access to any information from any outside source. And as soon as they're desperate not to be deemed apostates because they lose their families and they're banished from everything they've ever known.
Another aspect of this of the incredible dysfunction in this community is that in 2006, Warren was arrested, and he is the only one deemed to have the sealing power. So no marriages have taken place since he was arrested in 2006, so it has been 8 years, and young people who are teenagers there are now young adults with no hope of marriage unless they leave. And if they leave, they will be apostates. In addition, at the end of 2011, Warren dissolved all existing marriages, including legal marriages. He just said that people are not married anymore. They can no longer live together as husband and wife. So this, in my view, has created great deal of cognitive dissonance, because this is a people who's always placed great value on family formation, and now they're no longer allowed to form families. There's some other things going on in the connection to that, but I don't want to talk about it here. But it would be almost impossible to overstate the dysfunction of the FLES religion and people at this point. I hope that there are half the people who at least psychologically left, but as Ken says, they may not believe anymore, but they can't even say that in their family, because if word gets out that they have any questions about the prophet, they're going to be kicked out, and they're kicked out of the boat. The boat is going to drift away. The boat is going to be sped away, and your family is going to consider you leave with the devil.
Let me sort of give you another thing. One of the things I'm glad I've been involved with that community for a long time is that when I first came in there, they had a comfortable relationship with the outside world. They were not afraid of education. They had public schools there. There were a lot of college graduates around town. They were working at trying to have friendly relationships with the outside world. And, you know, there are other cities that were close. They had access to the media. They consume some of that stuff. They were socially and politically very conservative, but it was just a totally different world from after Warren came in and kind of took over. It's like somebody flipped a light switch and the lights went out down there. It's hard for me to wrap my head around how much attitudes have changed. And as I said, I don't have any good contacts who are living in the community and are still believing at this point. I have a lot of good friends who have left the community, been kicked out, and they're really struggling. You know, you don't just all of a sudden change your views when you've been raised in a system, a religious system. And personally, I am quite outraged at what Warren has done to a lot of families that I knew were really good, decent, honest, family-oriented people. I didn't agree with them on a lot of stuff, but these people weren't going to hurt anybody. And I just think, Warren, there will come a time when Warren will have to answer for that kind of damage to other human beings. And I'm not bothered. There were a lot of things about the way the Texas raid was conducted that bothered me, partly as a criminal defense lawyer and for other reasons. But with a final outcome as to where Warren is, I got no problems with that whatsoever.
And I would just add that it's been a blessing in my life to be able to be involved in, as a lawyer, trying to shut this craziness down for 10 years. And the people who have come out, and there's so many of them now, they go through a very painful process. When you start unraveling that rug of belief, how far do you unravel it? You know, it's very difficult. But they're wonderful people. I just completely agree with Ken. Some of my very dearest friends are people who have left, and they're wonderful people, but they're really in a tough position. The problem was institutionalized by 60 years of looking the other way. All these secondary crimes grew up out of polygamy, and now we don't have an institutional fix. People are basically on their own.
Race to the microphone.
Yeah, very funny. Doesn't this problem with the prophets assuming to be fallible or whatever, and people not to question, and, or as you said, teenage marriage, go all the way back to the prophet goes?
I've got a different take on that. I think the article that I wrote that Warren really didn't like had to do with something called the priesthood split, which is when the main body of fundamentalist Mormons basically broke apart in the early 1950s, and one group became the Apostolic United Brethren, and then the other group eventually became the FLDS. Well, at the time, their governing body was a priesthood council of about seven men, and the AUB has kept that priesthood council, which means you have to get a consensus in the body when you begin doing things. There is a check on somebody spinning off into crazy land. The FLDS let their priesthood council atrophy and came to this belief that one individual is the leader. There is no check on that one individual. I can't imagine anything like this ever happening with the AUB because of their sort of religious governing structure.
Concepts is dangerous, and the FLDS should be an example of all of this.
I agree with that completely.